Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
With the help of shock jocks and troll farms, you can fool some of the people some of the time. It takes leadership, competence, and courage to pass a bipartisan budget in divided government.
I can tell you, without the money, those planes are grounded. So if you have an emergency and need air rescue, do not call DPS. Rangers will not respond.
What the governor's staff needs to understand is this is her last chance. This is where we are, folks. We have a very basic budget to keep the lights on.
We want to make sure that we are doing our job and making government a government that works for the people and not the other way around.
Politics doesn't have to be in everything. This is about a team we all love, a team that provides incredible economic development to this state, and a point of pride.
Are you finally ready to admit you lost the 2022 Arizona election?
It saddens me that you are from Arizona and you're okay with
it. That's a yes or no question, Ms. Lake.
It saddens me that you are from Arizona.
I guess the answer is no, reclaiming my time.
And with me to talk about budget battles as the fiscal year draws to a close, a new record for gubernatorial vetoes, and more, are Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Mark.
And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Chuck, you have been around a few governors in your days.
Yes.
And you've been around a few legislatures and budget situations.
Yeah.
How does this one compare?
Fairly dysfunctional on a epic scale.
All right.
As Mr. Peterson was alluding to.
Charlatans.
It was shocking that he downloaded like that on the Freedom Caucus.
On the House.
Yeah, on the House. Well, and Jake Hoffman in his own chamber.
Fabulous.
And I was just shocked. I mean, Warren is a very conservative Republican, and he's just had it because, you know, the dysfunctional communication that's existed between the House and the Senate and not being on the same page. And, you know, he knows, as we all do. I mean, we go through this every budget cycle with people who are not in reality about if you have a Democratic governor, as Warren said, you have to work with them. It takes 16, 31, and 1. That's the rule. And what he was alluding to is the House's intransigence on that. And your last quote from Mr. Livingston on there was amusing because, well, the governor's going to learn. Well, I think Mr. Livingston has now learned that, you know, it takes the governor's signature.
Stacey, why was it that the House and Senate Republicans couldn't get on the same page?
Basic toddler behavior. If anyone has had a three-year-old, you know, you finish a meal. I want cake. Okay, well, you can have a cookie. We only have cookies. No, I want cake. Nope. You don't get cake. You don't get cake. There are only cookies, and you can only have one. I mean, that's—we were watching mom and dad scold the children in the House in a way that turned out to be pretty entertaining. They just don't—the House did not understand who's going to be signing the ultimate budget.
Well, so, Chuck, let me ask you this. Is there—you know, we talk about leadership a lot, and obviously Governor Hobbs has been through a few of these. Senate President Peterson has been through a few of these now. This is House Speaker Steve Montenegro's first session as Speaker. Did that have anything to do with this?
It had everything to do with it. It had everything to do with it. He's being chased by his Freedom Caucus in his own body. You know, he's got seven or eight people in his caucus that are Freedom Caucus members, and they generally did not support him for Speaker. And so for some reason, he felt obliged to let them go, let them do their thing. And there is wisdom in that. I mean, I remember talking to Rusty Bowers back in the day, and Rusty had this theory about the budget. He goes, you got to let the dogs run, Chuck. You got to let the dogs run. Get all this venom out of them. You know, maybe the mistake could have been that the Senate didn't vote on the House budget when they sent that over there and send that up to the governor and let her veto it. Maybe that was the point in which the train didn't stay on the track. But for whatever reason, the House and the Senate were not on the same page. And his speakership was being challenged from within.
Well, and I guess you could make the argument then, under that logic, that the way that Montenegro handled this maybe was the right way, right? Because he let the Freedom Caucus members pass two budgets that they wanted. The Senate eventually took them up. The governor vetoed them. And then they ended up with the budget that they probably would have ended up with in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, there's an argument to be made for that, that he had to do what he had to do, back into the Rusty Bowers analogy. Yeah. Let the dogs run. Let them get their energy out, you know, and then face reality. He didn't want to be the point. You know, the Senate was trying to be that reality point of saying, well, we've negotiated this. You didn't choose to negotiate. So there was some ego friction going on there.
Stacey, do you buy into the argument that since this budget had both bipartisan support and opposition, something that, you know, it was a budget that both Democrats and Republicans, some of them liked, some of them each hated, means it was maybe a good compromise?
That's exactly what it was. And it's always harder. This sounds counterintuitive, but it's harder when there's a surplus than when there's a deficit.
Yeah.
You know, figuring out what priorities get first slot is difficult.
You can't just say no to everybody.
Exactly. And when we're looking at what those priorities were that the governor and the Senate had negotiated, law enforcement raises, DPS, firefighters raises, I mean, those were really important pieces of policy that needed to move forward. So I think that those two, the administration and the Senate, did a great job delivering for Arizonans. And I think the House really took its toddler tantrum to the extreme.
Were you surprised at all to see the amount of public sniping? I mean, obviously, there's going to be friction all the time between different politicians and even between the House and Senate, but this one was very public.
Well, I was surprised, and I did not have on this year's bingo card me retweeting in support of Peterson's chief of staff, who detailed the daily rundown.
He sent out a thread on Twitter X about like how it all went down between the governor's office, the House, and Senate.
Setting the record straight. And I probably agree with nothing that in policy that gentleman recommends. But that's how he detailed that exchange was accurate.
The most amusing part was Livingston calling Peterson a rhino in a tweet. And then David's wife sends out a defend my husband tweet in the middle of it. And I'm like, okay, we're off the farm here. This is not productive.
That's never good.
Do both of you think that at the end of the day, the fact that we're, 4 days from the end of the fiscal year, is that what did it? Is that what broke it? Broke the logjam?
Yeah. And I think that finally the Senate just said, okay, we're going to let them do this little, as Stacey would say, this little tantrum, as Rusty would say, let the dogs run.
By putting the budgets up on the board.
Yeah, put them up, set them up, let her veto them, let her be the bad guy, and then get back to business. Today, I think right after this show, about 10 o'clock, they'll be concurring.
After they listen to this, of course.
Yes.
All 90.
I'm sure they're all glued.
All 90 of them, yeah.
So they'll go down and concur, and the budget will go up to the governor, and we'll have avoided the shutdown.
Stacey, what lessons do you take away from this? Because these groups still have one more year. I mean, whatever's left of this session,
right,
probably not that much, but then a whole nother year together. What, based on these last couple of weeks, what do you take away looking forward on?
Well, we have an administration that understands how this works. We've got a former House Minority Leader in Chad Campbell as the governor's chief. We've got the governor herself who served in the legislature. They understand how the sausage gets made. And certainly the Senate president does as well. So the House is going to have to play catch up and really do their work on how to be influential, perhaps not on a Twitter fight, but in the actual policymaking that puts this package together.
Chuck, what do you take away from these last couple of weeks? I'm specifically curious about the influence of the Freedom Caucus. You alluded to them, because it seems as though they were able to delay things and kind of gum up the works. But at the end of the day, they weren't really able to have the kind of influence on the final product that I would imagine they wanted.
Yeah. Historically, this would have been solved at the staff level. There would have been some mutual respect shared on both sides, and it fell apart for whatever reason. Michael Hunter's not down there anymore.
House Chief of Staff.
Experience. I mean, worked with us in the Brewer administration, worked in the House before that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a lot of experience in somebody like that. This is the first session without Michael. So I really look at it as a staff communication breakdown.
Is this something that you expect to carry over?
No. I think they'll figure it out. they'll figure it out. They don't want to go through this. I mean, they don't want to have to deal with this circus that they had to go through. And so, you know, they just got to figure out how to run the circus.
Stacey, let me ask you about the new, this is, I don't know if this is a record that Governor Hobbs wants to set, but a new, she broke her own record for the number of vetoes. The caveat here is that there were two budgets, which each contained, what, like 14
over a dozen,
or 15
yeah.
bills?
It's a well over a dozen.
So you get
yep.
a big chunk just in that, and she vetoed two of them. But, you know, her first year, she had a lot of vetoes. Second year, fewer. This year, the most. I mean, is there anything to take away from that?
So we're going to see some of the vetoes come back as zombie referrals. I expect to have a big, long ballot again.
Ballot referrals. Yeah,
ballot referrals. There's, I don't know, 7, 10 that have already been filed as referrals. So voters are going to make decisions on some of this. But some of the bills that she vetoed were objectively terrible, like re-legalizing silencers, making silencers great again. You know what's worse than a mass shooting? Not hearing one start. I mean, this is terrible. Like, of course she should veto silencers. There was a bill that didn't allow for cities to reduce public safety funding. Public safety was against that. I mean, we've been through a recession. We understand how budgets work. The Arizona Police Association asked her to veto that. I mean, we're talking about some really strange things that the legislature popped up to her.
Yeah, Chuck, what do you mean? I mean, you've worked with a couple governors.
Yeah.
They don't have this record.
No, but this legislature's got a track record of sending HCRs of stuff that
ballot
goes
referrals.
To the ballot.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And she's 100% right. I think they believe that helped them last time. They had a bunch of stuff on the ballot that, you know, they could narrate and they could sell to their base, and that they believe that helped them. So one of those was defeated last night in the House. They tried to put up a photo radar ban for the ballot, and it did not muster the 31 votes necessary to get over the finish line. But at the end of the day, the bigger story here is, you know, it really comes down to the governor. I mean, so she's going to campaign. That's going to be her message. These people are crazy. You know, I'm your backstop. I'm your here. Is that enough? Is that enough in the age of Trump to say, is that enough to convince voters to say, hey, I'm going that way because I'm scared of that? Or does somehow the Republican primary end up generating some ideas about how we move forward that she will have to react to? I think that's the really big question going forward. You know, you have big water issues in the state.
Yeah.
We have public education funding issues going on in the state,
yep.
as we always do.
Mm-hmm.
We have mental health funding issues going forward in the state, as we always do. You have, you know, local autonomy on zoning and housing going forward on what we need as a state. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, it's not a good enough answer to just say, well, I vetoed. You know, you got to lead at some point. Somebody's got to figure out how to lead down there.
Are you suggesting a campaign might be about policy?
Maybe. That's why I'm now 63, Mark, and maybe why I don't do this anymore.
Chuck's getting soft. Look at this.
Stacey, let me start with you on what has been known as the Diamondbacks bill. After a lot of negotiation, a lot of delay, this bill is headed to the governor. The conventional wisdom is that she will sign it. It's a way for the D-backs to basically, the bill will divert some money, some tax revenue, to a district, the stadium district, to help the Diamondbacks refurbish Chase Field. Is this seems like one of those, again, we talked about the budget, has bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. But this is one that it seemed like the governor was fairly engaged on and really trying to come up with some kind of deal on.
For sure. And in full disclosure, my business partner was one of the lead lobbyists on this. And my former business partner really likes baseball. so that might have something to do with it. But the truth is, we can't rewind how the stadium was built to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
The taxpayers own it. There's no time machine. We can't go 30 years ago and decide we didn't want to own it. The taxpayers don't want to own it. And now we have an albatross with no air conditioning at the corner of Main and Main getting into downtown Phoenix. And taxpayers needed to fix it. And regardless of whether or not you care about baseball or think that public financing should even be on the table, if the baseball team moved away, we'd have to tear it down. There's still an expense. This still was a building that taxpayers owned. So you had to decide whether or not you want baseball to be played in it or you want to take it down.
Well, Chuck, that was an argument that a lot of supporters of this bill set. You heard over and over, this is a building that the public owns. So we should take care of it.
Yeah, hats off to Jeff Winninger, who had the courage to sponsor the
Agreed.
Bill in the House.
State representative, yeah.
Yeah. You know, he sponsored it based on that thematic. And I got it. I mean, I was around when Mary Rose got shot.
Yeah.
When Jim Bruner lost his campaign for Congress because he supported the baseball stadium. But the basic fact is, Stacey's right, this was a taxpayer-built building, and we'd walked away from the maintenance of the facility and the obligation to sustain that. $250 million back in the day, probably a half a billion today or more. And so we have an investment. So what do you do with the investment? I mean, that's a brass tacks question. I was happy to see Mr. Winninger support it. I was delighted to see the veteran legislator, J.D. Mesnard, dig in, because I think he's probably the only person in the Capitol that would have been capable of getting that deal done.
Is this a tough one optically because of what the building is? It's a baseball stadium run by, you know, one of the richest owners in baseball.
Politically active.
Who's politically active.
And you have,
and you have players playing there who all make millions, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. As a taxpayer, it seems like it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to say, why don't they pay for it? Why am I paying for it?
Just not happening in anywhere in major league sports today. Vegas is building a brand new stadium at public money. It's a luxury that if you want as a community, which means that you're now part of the elite communities in the country, if you want this, then you got to figure out how to host them. And as you said, most of those players are making hundreds of millions of dollars. Now their income tax dollars are going to go to the stadium. And so you can make that argument that it's a self-contained economic enterprise, which generates additional economic enterprise around it.
Stacey, another bill going up to the governor is the so-called Ag to Urban bill. This is one that would essentially allow developers to buy the water rights of farms if the farmers decide to sort of hang it up and not run their farms anymore. And supporters say it's a way to build more homes, help deal with the housing crisis while also saving water. There are some water folks who say it's not really going to have that kind of effect. But one of the things that struck me was that a number of supporters were comparing this bill to the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, saying this is the most significant piece of water legislation since that time. I'm curious if you agree with that.
So I absolutely do. And this was not an easy piece of policy to pass.
It's been a couple
either.
Years.
Yeah,
in
it's
making.
Been multiple years, right? But alfalfa objectively uses more water than a house. I mean, it's just how this works. And so we know the direction farming is going, and it's not the little guys anymore. They're all being bought out by conglomerates, and we know that housing's a crisis, and it's the top of mind for voters and top of mind for folks trying to find a place to live. So this it certainly was complicated policy, and it was nice to see it get done.
2 years ago, Dave Roberts, who used to be the head of SRP Water, wrote a piece in the Arizona Republic that said, "Hey, as we retire these farms, we should give the credit to a developer, some credit, not all of it, but
the
we should
credits.
Give some credits to a developer to be able to use some of that water, because we all know housing uses less water than ag." That makes perfect sense. I mean, it does make perfect sense. That's what was done here. It makes perfect sense. The governor up to this point had been attempting to leverage the legislature to do something about rural groundwater, because that's a problem still. You have 80% of the state has no groundwater regulation. So you, Mark, are an industrial farmer. You come in, you drop a 5,000-acre well next to Stacy and me, who is our little 10-acre property, and you start pumping 5,000 gallons a minute. Stacy and my well goes dry. We're SOL. We don't have anything to say about that. That's not just. That is wrong. We've been unable to, up till now and through now, to get through the agriculture, the realtors, and the ranchers Those are fairly significant entities down at the legislature.
Yeah.
And most significantly, Gail Griffin, who's the natural resources policy chairman, to find some compromise on that.
Yeah.
It is disappointing to me that, you know, I understand why she did it. I understand that it's an election. It's coming up on an election year, and I got to have these people be happy with me. But I would have preferred her to hold the line until next year and see if we'd gotten something finally done on this.
On rural.
And then sign. I would agree with you that it's a big water change. The biggest water change, if we can get it done, would be this Groundwater Management Act.
All right. Yeah. Guys, a few minutes left. I want to ask you about what seems like a fairly decent-sized snafu coming from the Maricopa County Recorder's Office. And, Chuck, I'll start with you with the caveat that you do some work with the County Board of Supervisors.
We do.
So this was a letter that went out to, I think, 83,000 voters in Maricopa County, essentially telling them that they were going to be removed from the active voting list if they did not respond, when in fact they should have gotten letters that said they were part of this MVD situation where they didn't prove proof of citizenship when they initially registered to vote and shouldn't have been voting on the entire ballot. It seems, if nothing else, confusing for, you know, tens of thousands of voters in this county.
Yeah. It's disappointing that they are not acting in concert. Mr. Heap has been picking a partisan fight.
The recorder.
Yes. With the Republican board for some time. So in defense, there was a significant change in policy at the end of Mr. Richards' term where he gave back to the board a bunch of responsibilities. Mr. Heap objected to that. Tom Galvin, the county chairman of the Board of Supervisors, said, okay, let's talk about it. Let's work out an agreement to do that. And then, you know, Mr. Heap hired a political operative who's not known for getting along with anybody. And now we get stuff like this that tries to make everybody look bad. You know, the board has been trying to do what it's been trying to do in the best interest of all the voters of Maricopa County. I would suggest maybe Mr. Heap is being a little bit more partisan minded about that. And now you have these squabbles which spill over into actually how to do your job. And it's disappointing that there isn't clarity about the letter that you suggested, that, as Stacy alluded, this has been going on for some time. We could just tell people, hey, this is the issue. This is how you remedy the issue.
Yeah, Stacey, very briefly, in the recorder's office is saying this was a printing error.
Oh, come on. you have one job as a recorder, which is to record things accurately, be it votes, be it documents, whatever it is. And I just want to remind folks that Justin Heap at the legislature was a tinfoil hat wearing election denier. And what we're seeing here is an extension of that platform. I mean, the guy truly thought that aliens or space lasers could get into our machines. It's insanity.
Well, I guess we have to leave it there.
I'm not sure what to call that, but we'll
leave it there. Stacey Pearson, Chuck Hoffman, thanks to you both.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.